Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe.
Sponsored by Wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.
Hey, everybody. How are you? I'm Larry Port. This is another episode of the Dream Job Cafe, and I'm very pleased to be joined with the author, Scott Sturrett, author of The Uncertainty Advantage, Landing Your Career in an Era of Rapid Change. I thought there could be no more appropriate book to talk about in this day and age. Scott, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Scott, tell me a little bit about like how this book happened. Like, why did you decide to write it?
There were two main things that motivated me to write this book. The first was my experience founding a national charity called Venture for Canada, where over close to 12 years, I played a role in supporting almost 10,000 young Canadians to launch their careers across the country.
Wow.
And what I saw in my work at Venture for Canada is that one of the most significant, if not the most significant thing that holds young people back in their careers is a fear of uncertainty. It prevents people from taking risks. And in an uncertain world, we all need to take risks in order to get ahead. So that's what motivated me first and foremost to write this book. The second thing that motivated me to write this book is my own personal challenges in navigating uncertainty in my 20s. I was super anxious in my 20s and teens. When I think back to that time now, I can feel the anxiety in my like memories. And that's not to say that I'm cured of anxiety. I still have anxious moments, but I think I'm a much more in aggregate, like relaxed person today. And I wanted to write a resource that I thought would be helpful to my younger self. And later on, we can talk a little bit too about my experience getting diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, which at the core is a fear of uncertainty and was also a motivator in me writing this book.
Wow. Okay. So, well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you're very frank and open in this book, you know, about the various challenges in your life. And I think like, especially like having kids in college and following what's going on with the anxious generation, as it's called, that's a big deal. Let me ask you this question. And I think one of the reasons that this resonated with me so much is that there's a real sense in this book that you've kind of climbed the mountain, that you've faced challenges and overcome them. And one of the things that I feel like in my life is that there's a lot of crazy stuff going on, but if you have courage and you follow through with things, it kind of repeats itself. It kind of is like a muscle that grows. I mean, that kind of came through in your writing, and I just wanted to know if you had anything to say about that.
Two different things. I think the first one, well, appreciate the kind words about climbing the mountain, and I think I partially climbed the mountain. That's not to say that I'm cured, you know, of anxiety, but I think that I am a much more relaxed, grounded person than I was like 5 years ago. For context, 5 years ago, I was like the worst of my OCD, almost exactly to this day.
Wow.
And I really struggled to like get out of the house. I struggled to like function. I was like a ball of anxiety. And certainly that was part of the reason why I was motivated to write this book, is I feel like I learned a ton from that experience. The second key point, though, that I want to emphasize is I think a big part of the reason why I wrote this book is I went through an extremely challenging time, by far the darkest point in my life. Candidly, when I think back to that time, it honestly feels like a nightmare. Like I always heard people say that, but that time was, it feels like it was a bad dream. Like it feels like I had my life and then there was like a 6 month period that was absolutely brutal. And I think a lot of writing this book for me was about meaning making, about moving forward with that traumatic experience. And how can I learn from that? And hopefully, how can I extract lessons from that experience that are then valuable to other people so that they can have a better life and potentially avoid some of the mistakes that I made in my 20s?
Wow. Well, let's get into it. So this is the book. Again, you can see I like heavily marked it up. In my opinion, it's worth getting just for the recommended reading section alone, which is excellent. So the book is The Age of Uncertainty, and there's six pillars, and we're just going to kind of take them one by one. But they are in this order: nurture self-compassion, cultivate an adaptable mindset, develop anti-fragility, master key generalist skills, adopt an entrepreneurial mindset and build a strong professional network. And, you know, this is like for people launching their careers, but I think it has lessons in there even for me. So let's talk about the nurture self-compassion chapter. You want to talk a little bit about this first pillar?
I chose self-compassion as the first pillar of the book because in many ways, I think self-compassion is the most important aspect of developing a better relationship with the unknown. And self-compassion includes three kind of core elements. The first is the importance of being kind to yourself or talking to yourself in a gentle way. Think about how you would talk to your friend if they were going through a challenging circumstance. The second core piece of advice or second core aspect of self-compassion is the importance of being mindful of being aware of how you're feeling in the moment. And the third core aspect of self-compassion is the importance of recognizing your shared humanity, that if you're going through a challenging time, you're not alone. And just in recognizing that you're not alone, you can gradually feel less anxious and be more effective at coping. And it's important to recognize that self-compassion isn't kind of woo-woo, just sitting on a beach, eating Doritos all day. That I'm also a believer about being ambitious, about pushing yourself. And the third pillar of the book is all about going out of your comfort zone. So self-compassion also, I think, has to be married with ambition and drive and taking risks. But I think self-compassion is so important because we live in such a relentlessly competitive society. And what I've noticed in my experiences with young people, as well as my own lived experience in my 20s, is that so many people struggle with being relentlessly self-critical. And it's partially because of this epidemic of perfectionism that we have and that a lot of young people suffer from. So I can talk into a little bit more about how to foster more self-compassion. But for now, I'll just emphasize that I think self-compassion is something that is really critical for people in learning to develop a better relationship with uncertainty. Because in an uncertain world, a lot can go wrong. And it's important to be kind to yourself when things don't work out.
Yeah, So a couple things there. You have this one thing where you talk about comparing yourself to others. And there's a quote by the American president, and Scott, by the way, is Canadian. So I don't, Theodore Roosevelt has a great quote. He says, comparison is the thief of joy, right? And you talk about like social media comparison, and you say, I'm just going to read it. You see friends announcing promotions, new ventures, and seemingly perfect personal lives. It can make you wonder if you're doing enough. And then you talk about this experience, but then you also say, it reminded me that we never truly know what's going on behind the scenes in someone else's life. Like, so I think this is a real problem with people who are on social media all the time. And so, you know, how might, and I just want to stress, like, a lot of the book is like, okay, here's an issue that's happening, and here's some steps to maybe mitigate it. So can you just like maybe take this example to like what you advise people to like mitigate that social comparison they're seeing on social media?
There are a few things that someone can do. I think the first is just minimize your social media consumption, time box it, create kind of limitations for yourself. Remove social media from your phone is a second kind of piece of advice that to just reduce the amount of time. Another would be to create time limits on your phone if you feel like they're needed, that like block you if you spent too much time. And, you know, I'd say that maybe a final piece of advice is that, you know, while using social media, just being mindful and aware of when you get into that creeping comparison. By the way, I still get into the comparison trap and I can still struggle with that. I think most people do. But I think for me, I actually get a lot of joy from social media in some ways. I find it professionally helpful. I'm not an anti-social media person. I think the thing that's most helpful is just being mindful of when I'm falling into the comparison trap and then gently redirecting to, you know, a healthier mindset of, we all have our own path, our own story. And also you don't know what's going behind the scenes and it's not a competition.
Right. Well, and I can see, yeah, that's where the mindfulness discussion comes into play because a lot of it is like, and meditation has a similar concept where a thought pops into your head and you kind of note it. So there's this separation of like my mind just racing and then the real eye behind it saying like, okay, you're thinking about this, like, I think that's a huge idea. Can you talk about like being on the sidelines to like your own mental process maybe a little bit and why that's so important?
Yeah, the me versus I distinction, I think is a really important one in meditation. I think it's also in kind of Buddhism. There's a great book that I reference in my book by a Jesuit priest who lived in India. I'm forgetting his name, but in it, you know, he talks about that difference between there's, you know, your actual self, your kind of observing self, and then there's like your thought self, which is kind of like jumping around and is a little bit different than you. And I think just being able to be detached, like to have one part of you just observing yourself and kind of your frenetic kind of mind that's going all over the place, and to do that in as much as possible, like a non-judgmental way, I find that that's really helpful at developing a healthy relationship with thoughts. The final thing I'd share is that, yeah, I still struggle. Like there's someone I was kind of upset with about something, and I was having a lot of negative thoughts about this person, and it was kind of getting obsessive. I was like, this is like annoying. I want
a lot of rumination, that kind of thing.
Yeah, rumination. It was just this week. And then I was reflecting like, okay, I'm just going to let these thoughts go as long as they want. Like, I'm not resisting. What resists persists, in the word of Carl Jung, the psychologist. And I found that by adopting more of this like observing kind of mindset, eventually those thoughts have like kind of drifted away. But where I've gotten into trouble is when I've really resisted and I've been like, this thought needs to get out of my head right now. That's when that thought stays on for like forever, and you can get into this rumination train. All that's to say is that having an observer mindset to your own thoughts and to be as much as possible non-judgmental, I think can help you live in a healthier way. And ultimately also, I think, develop a healthier relationship with uncertainty too.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important skills that a person can actually develop. Personally, it frees you up. It allows you to kind of like maybe even like poke fun at yourself and like, you know what I mean? Like in a gentle, loving way. So this is like kind of foundational tools to kind of move forward. And then you kind of hit us with this one. I love this paragraph you write. You say, the days of predictable straight line career paths are over. Today, a career isn't a simple progression, but a series of pivots, detours, and unexpected opportunities. It's something not to fear, but to embrace. So I agree. So, I mean, it's not the age of our grandfathers and fathers and grandmothers and mothers, right? It's a different thing. We are not going to be we're not going to be working for IBM for 40 years and getting a pension. Is that what you mean by this? Or am I reading it my own way?
That's exactly what I mean. I think the era of the linear career path is increasingly going away. And that poses some challenges in the sense there's more uncertainty for us. But I also think it's important to emphasize that it's really exciting. I think this is one of the most exciting times in human history to have a career. And I think a lot of people are scared by the uncertainty, but it's important to recognize all the possibility that lies within that uncertainty too.
Yeah. And also it kind of lowers the stakes a little bit. If you're in college and you're like, okay, what am I going to do for my life? I don't know that you're really choosing what you're going to do for your life. Maybe you're going to choose what you're going to be doing for the next 3 to 5 years. So like, I feel like a recognition of that, like you said, if looked at it the right way, it should de-stress the situation, because you can always course correct and you can always change. And it's not like the old days where everybody was working the same job and you're kind of the weirdo who had to switch things around. No, everybody's switching things around. So I think it's very good. All right, we're taking all of our time on the first pillar. I think we need to move along here. Actually, we went into the second pillar. How about that? All right, let me ask you this one. So you say here, and I love this, I was telling you about this before we started recording, is that a lot of people tell you to follow your passion, but that might not be the best advice. Why is it not the best advice to follow your passion?
Follow your passion can be really dangerous advice for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that we have many different passions. So often it's follow your passion, it's not follow your passions. And that's a mistake. It's okay to have many passions.
I
have many
passions. Right.
So that's one piece of why that advice is poor. A second reason why it's poor is that a lot of times, even if like there's situations where people have multiple passions, but there's also situations where people have no passions, particularly if they're maybe starting their career. They maybe have interests, but maybe not passions. And follow your passion kind of behooves somebody to pick like one passion that is going to, you know, define themselves in their life. And instead, I think Cal Newport in his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, his advice is really spot on. And he says, focus on making yourself more useful to the world. And in doing so, you discover new passions. So that's the second piece of why follow your passion is bad advice. The third reason why follow your passion is really bad advice is it's because our passions like evolve over time. So what you may be passionate about at 22 is different than when you're 40, and that's okay. The follow your passion advice kind of encourages people to like lock in to like one thing, when that's pretty like unrealistic. And to our earlier conversation, most people are going to have their careers change a lot. So for all of those reasons, I think follow your passion causes people a lot of emotional heartbreak. It causes a lot of people to put a lot of pressure on themselves. And instead, I think Newport's advice on like make yourself useful, develop useful skills, that's a lot better advice in the long run.
Yeah, I really particularly enjoyed that. By the way, this pillar is the second pillar, which is cultivate an adaptable mindset. I don't know if you have anything else you want to mention on that chapter before we get into anti-fragility.
One other aspect I think that's really important on the topic of adaptability is just being really clear about like what are your like life values that kind of like guide you, and what's your mission statement that guides you as well. And it's amazing. I've done, you know, like 60 talks, most of them kind of interactive about the uncertainty advantage. And in those talks, I'll ask people to share what is their personal like mission statement, or raise their hand if they have a personal mission statement. And like 10% of people can like state what their personal mission statement is. And I think that's really sad, because we're all here for like a reason. I think we all have like a deep sense of like purpose. And I think that we can end up getting into a lot of traps in an uncertain world when we don't believe in anything. And there's a famous line by Chesterton where he said that a man who believes in nothing will believe in anything or everything. And I think that that's really true. So in an uncertain world, it's important to be adaptable in the short term, be really adaptable in terms of your career planning, but be really clear in terms of what is your like core kind of like values. And I think that we're in some ways a values like crisis today. I think that we're often in a society where there's a huge emphasis on just greed and just winning and external kind of validation. And I think as a result, because of social pressure, people can get pulled into really bad decisions. And you only have to follow the news to see some of those really bad decisions that people can make. So anyway, I encourage folks as they navigate this uncertain world to be adaptive, but to be really clear about what is their mission, what are their values. And in writing this book and talking so much about mission statement values, it's caused me to use it a lot more in my own life to evaluate decisions and to ultimately, you know, think back to them when I'm facing moral dilemmas or complex situations, which I deal with, but I'm sure everyone else deals with. That's part of living in our world. And it's particularly important in an uncertain world.
Yeah. Well, you use the word navigate, like, you know, and if you're navigating these kind of things, your values and your mission statement are the points on the compass. They're the ones that are going to direct you. We did a lot of work on this when I ran my company Rocket Matter, and I've done my own personal work on it too, but like at a company level, it was amazing because it allowed you to figure out like who was going to work with the team and who wasn't going to work with the team, or should this project be adopted or should it not? It really helps you answer a lot of different questions. Now, this next one, I had never heard of before. I had never heard of anti-fragility. You want to kind of give us a heads up what that is?
Anti-fragility is originally actually an investment term that I've applied to the context of career development. An anti-fragile thing or person becomes stronger in the face of setbacks rather than weaker. And that goes beyond resilience. Resilience is just simply surviving a challenging circumstance. Anti-fragility is becoming stronger. A lot of startups can become stronger in the face of chaos. They're set up to kind of thrive from uncertain situations or rapidly changing market situations. And I'd encourage individuals or people starting their career to think about ways that they can leverage or design their life so that they actually thrive from chaos. Within the book, I talk a lot about the importance of risk-taking, because I think it's being a smart risk-taker is a big way that you become more anti-fragile. Because how do you take advantage of opportunities? How do you deal with chaos? You take risks. And in the book, I provide practical takeaways on how do you build your risk-taking muscles over time? And how do you build a mindset where you become more tolerant to making smart risks?
See, this is kind of what I was alluding to before. And you write this in your book. You say, success isn't about dramatic leaps into the unknown. It's about the careful cultivation of courage, the patient building of confidence, and the wisdom to recognize that every skill, no matter how seemingly unrelated, can become part of a larger success story. Like, I think the reason that like that particular passage resonated with me is because what I found is that when I had to do something truly courageous, I was never the same person afterwards. I was more courageous. And then that led me to be able to take even, I don't want to call them reckless risks, but it allowed me to wade into situations that required even more courage and to see there. And it was like almost like going to the gym and exercising a muscle. Did you have a similar experience that I did?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that building your risk-taking capacity is like a muscle. Like the more you work it out, the stronger it gets. Also, the less you work it out, the weaker it gets. And that's why on the point of self-compassion, self-compassion is good. But if you're using self-compassion as an excuse for not taking risks, then it's not good. That's not what self-compassion is. And it's really important to take risks and to constantly push yourself out of your comfort zone. I led Venture for Canada for like 11 and a half years. Around a year and a half ago, I decided I'm getting too cozy here. I need a challenge. I need to change things up. I'm leaving Venture for Canada. I gave kind of notice. It took us around a year to hire the new CEO. And then I left and now doing new things. And it's funny, as we do this interview, I'm around 2 weeks into kind of a new role, and it's so exciting and it's so fun. And I feel more energized actually about like life and work, but it's also more unknown. It's more uncertain. And I'm so glad I made that decision, even though I could have probably done Venture for Canada for another 10 or 20 years and had an interesting kind of career. I use that example because it's both top of mind, but I think it is a real practical example of if you are getting too cozy or too comfortable in your career, it's important to change things up and it's important to take risks. And that's ultimately how you can be on a path, I think, to achieve your full potential. Like you don't want to just coast. And I think if you're just coasting, you're really at a risk of getting left behind in a world that evolves extremely rapidly.
So you also say this, you also say that there's often more risk in playing it safe than in taking a calculated leap, which I think is entirely true. I mean, if you're like, okay, you know what? The startup world's not for me. I don't want to work for startup companies. I don't want to start a startup company. And I'm not saying people have to do that, but I think it makes more sense for me to like stick with Microsoft and getting the job there. I mean, they've laid off like 10,000 people or more this year. So I think, you know, and you mentioned finances. It's the same thing with finances. If you put all your money in the safest stuff like bonds, that's actually riskier than diversifying it with more risky things, right? So it's a little bit counterintuitive, but it's safer to take risk in some ways. I don't know.
I agree. I mean, I think it applies to investments. Like if someone had just put all their money in bonds over the last 5 years, wouldn't it have been a great investment? You know, you'd be like, I think negative, like 10% yeah. when the market has like gone up. So how much money have you lost in opportunity kind of cost? Like huge amount. That being said, you know, also if you put all your money in like Bitcoin and all your money in, you know, Tesla stock, there's like a risk in that too. So it's to say that I think risk, there's a risk in not taking risks. With that caveat that I also think it's important for young people to recognize that there's a Goldilocks point on risk taking. Like you want to take risks, but you want to take smart risks. And everyone has different socioeconomic realities too. Like I think if you're a 20-year-old and you're giving money, you know, you're working and you're helping pay for, you know, your parents' like livelihoods, then you yeah. might take that job at Microsoft that is like high paying. Like you want to optimize for like earning like that
right.
I think it's probably
here they're paying down a lot of student debt, you know, American students, so that's
yeah
the case.
It makes a lot of sense, but I think for a lot of people who don't have that kind of maybe restriction, then I'd say if you're young, go for it. Like take really big risks, go launch a business. That's the time I think to do it. What I often hear from people too when I've done sessions is that once they've had a kid or a first kid or a second kid, that changes their rationale too. Like it impacts their risk taking. And I think that's like rational. That being said, as you said, there are huge risks in not taking risks. And for instance, when I was 22, I quit a job at Goldman Sachs in New York City. And while Goldman Sachs is an amazing place for many people, for me, it was not a good fit because I didn't study finance. I had no interest in the subject matter. I wasn't particularly good at my job. And I just kind of went there because it was prestigious. And I knew, oh, I like the ego boost of saying that I worked at Goldman Sachs in New York City. But for me to be really successful in that career, it wasn't probably a good fit for me. And I remember thinking at that time, okay, I can either do this job or I can quit to go do Venture for Canada, where I'm a lot more passionate about it. And that is a little bit of it. But more fundamentally, my skills were way more aligned. And I'm so glad I made that decision because I think there would have been a big risk for me in staying in a dead-end job that wasn't a good alignment with my own career interests.
Wow. And for those not in the know, like Goldman is like the number one firm in Wall Street. So this is an interesting thing. And I like the fact that you mentioned this is a lot of times right now, it's a polarized society politically. People tend to entrench themselves and there's not a lot of room for compromise. And it's just people get stuck into thinking and they want to combat the other side. You tell the story or this anecdote. I guess it's an old Greek parable about the fox and the hedgehog. So who's a fox and who's a hedgehog?
So I always get mixed up, but I do love this kind of parable where
it's the fox is a good guy. The hedgehog is a guy you don't want to be.
The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one thing.
Right.
And essentially this comes from Isaiah Berlin, and who's like a philosopher, talks about that foxes are people that have the ability to think across a wide range of paradigms and intellectual traditions and read widely. And they use a lot of different frameworks when they're making kind of decisions. And a hedgehog is somebody who focuses on uses one paradigm to like define the world. So I think in the book, the example I use would be if someone's like a Marxist and you think of like a Marxist historian or just someone who's a Marxist in general, they'll think of everything in the world in the context of like class struggle.
Everything's through that lens.
Everything, right? Everything is about kind of class and the struggle of class. And, you know, I think Isaiah Berlin is right that the fox knows many more things. The fox can be a lot more adaptive in a world that is really uncertain. And I would encourage people to be foxes because I think when you're a hedgehog and you close yourself out to other ways of thinking, you are more likely to make a really big mistake potentially because sometimes one way of thinking works well in one setting, but in another setting, another way of thinking kind of works better. So I love this parable. I think it applies, to a lot of different aspects of life, including some of our current polarization, not just in the US, but, around the world.
Yeah, I think, thinking is like a tool. And if you show up to fix something and you only have one tool and you have a hammer and you need a screwdriver, you're kind of screwed. No pun intended. Well, pun intended. But all right. So that was the anti-fragility chapter. Now there's one on master key generalist skills. You tell this pretty cool story about somebody who takes a boot camp like coding course and then gets into an organization, but because they had like a different background, it allowed them to grow. You say, in an age of uncertainty, perhaps the most specialized skill of all is the ability to adapt, learn, and make connections across different domains. It's about having the flexibility to pivot when the circumstances change, which is kind of related to what we were just talking about with Fox.
Yeah, totally. And I think the ability to be adaptive is one of the most important things that anyone can do in their lives and careers, particularly as the world changes so quickly. And a core aspect of that is like learning to learn. The ability to be a lifelong learner is more important as skills get automated away and the skills needed to thrive in our economy change. I was reading an article recently, it was talking about just the change in job titles within startups. And there's so many job titles today that like 15 years ago didn't exist. Like go-to-market engineer has become like a really popular job title. Still like a little bit trendy, but it's like 2 years ago, pretty much no one knew a GTM engineer. I think it's just a title that emerged in the last like a year and a half. Or head of community, a title that has been more common for like maybe a decade. But like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, there were no heads of community really at startups, I think, with that kind of title. And certainly 100 years ago, if you were to share some of the job titles that exist today, people would be like, what is like that? Like TikTok growth lead or like all that's to say is that the jobs that exist are evolving at a more quick pace, which means people need to be more adaptive, but they also need to be more enthusiastic at embracing lifelong learning and being more effective at lifelong learning too.
So, well, there's never been a better time. I mean, you can get coursework on anything these days. I mean, this chapter is very prescriptive. There's like a lot of like techniques on communication skills and things like that. There's some really cool tools that you mentioned here. I don't know that we need to go into it, but some of my favorites, like the Pomodoro technique for avoiding procrastination, the Eisenhower matrix, which I first saw in Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, I think, right? Well, you wouldn't know that, I guess, where I first saw it. But I want to call out specifically, and this kind of goes back to our conversation about courage. You talk about confrontation here. Confrontation is scary for a lot of people. And it used to be scary for me before I married somebody of Italian heritage. Now it's no longer that way. So, but you say avoiding conflict only makes it worse. Then you talk about being assertive, not aggressive. You say assertiveness doesn't mean being pushy or confrontational. It means clearly expressing your needs and expectations while respecting others. So I call this out specifically because I think so many people have a problem with confrontation, and avoiding the confrontation leads to many worse problems down the road. What can you tell people about that?
Some of the biggest mistakes I've made in my career is when I have avoided confrontation or I've kicked something down the road. I think that the strongest relationships are ones where people bring up when they aren't happy about something. They do that in a respectful way, but they are honest about how they feel. I actually saw this like TikTok video about this, and it was saying that relationships where one person or both people feel, or let's say where one person doesn't feel like they have the safe space to like share that or to be honest about how they're actually thinking, that's not a relationship. It's like a hostage situation.
Oh, geez. And that's good.
It kind of stuck with me. I was like, yeah, that's kind of a true point. And certainly I can know, not necessarily think relationships I have with people, but I know of other people's relationships where sometimes it does feel a little bit like from the outside, it looks like it's like a little bit of a hostage kind of situation. And all to say is that I think if you want to have authentic, strong, lasting relationships, that doesn't mean that you're agreeing with people all the time. The strongest relationships are actually ones where there are dissent and there are disagreement. And I think that's really, you know, important. So if you're, most people don't love conflict. I think what's important is that, you know, you bring up the concerns and you don't just let them fester. The one other thing that I would add to that I think is important on this topic is that it's not always a safe space to dissent. So I think being careful, like when you're giving feedback to your boss, right? Or when you're giving feedback to someone you don't know. Like I'm sharing this feedback of, oh, it's important to express dissent and to be honest. But I also think at the same time, it's important to have caveats that it's also important as a young person to like navigate the room, to be aware. And I think to give that feedback when you understand that it's safe to do so, because there are some people who will bring negative repercussions against you because they don't want any negative, you know, feedback. And in those cases, you know, it probably makes sense just to keep it to yourself, particularly if they're in a position of power. That being said, for most situations, I think it's more effective to be honest about how you're actually feeling so you can build a stronger relationship with that person.
You know, one of the probably most important skills book that I read was a book called Crucial Conversations. And it wasn't particularly a fun read, but it was very instructional into like how to like have conversations that are like not easy. And because they will come up and it's important that they're addressed. So I do think it's a very important muscle to exercise. Then you have, tell me a little bit about this chapter, Adopting an Entrepreneurial Mindset.
This chapter is very close to my heart because I founded Venture for Canada, which at the core is around helping young people be entrepreneurial. And to be entrepreneurial is to identify and act upon opportunities to create value for others. And I think an entrepreneurial mindset is important for everyone, not just founders. And there are two core aspects of being entrepreneurial. The first is the importance of identifying opportunities, and the second is the importance of acting upon them. And the way that you can identify opportunities is through being an omnivorous reader, It's through being someone who talks to a wide range of people. And in doing so, you gain the ability over time to be a great synthesizer of ideas and ultimately to come up with ideas that are more novel, more overlooked, and have more potential. But more than just coming up with ideas, it's important to be a person who tests ideas, who constantly tinkers, who experiments. And I think in our era, particularly with AI, where in some ways it's easier to be a tinkerer than ever before, it's important to adopt this mindset of entrepreneurial action. And I highly recommend people read Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, where he talks about the build, measure, kind of iterate loop and how you can leverage this adaptive, iterative mindset to help you in your career and to embrace entrepreneurial thinking.
Yeah, well, that's a big thing is you talk a lot about that. You talk a lot about how just start something. And I, you know, it's kind of funny. When I started my company, somebody told me, like shortly before I did it, that there's never a good time to start a company, to buy a house, to get married, to have a kid. So there's never a good time. So just might as well do it, right? Now, maybe for me, it was a very bad time because I had a 6-month-old, but I did it anyhow and it worked out well. But you do talk a lot about just kind of like rolling up your sleeves and getting started. So like, you know, I think a lot of people fall into the trap of like, we call it in the software industry, analysis paralysis, but just like planning and like never doing anything. Or like, is there a sweet spot between like taking a look at something and jumping in? Or like how do people know when to get going?
I do think some research first makes a lot of sense. You don't want to just like dive into something. But I think having more of a bias to action than a bias to research is important. What I'd encourage folks to do is like leverage the lean startup type system of like build some kind of minimum viable product and get it out there and start testing. And at Venture for Canada, we launched the main programming in Canada that trains people how to buy businesses. And the way that we tested whether there was like demand for these courses was we would put out like a landing page with like really sparse information, put some ad money, and then see like how many people like sign up for this like course. And when we had like 200 people fill out this landing page, we were like, okay, we're onto something. We're launching this. All to say, there's different versions of a minimum viable product, but I think trying as much as possible to get like something out there quickly is better than spending like a year writing a business plan. That being said, for a lot of things, like a minimum viable product can take 2 or 3 months to get out. Like, I mean, sometimes there'll be things now with like AI where people would be like, oh, I did it in like 2 days. But I think to like, yeah. I think to like think through something seriously and have it, you know, minimum viable product isn't like a car that's like falling apart. So I think sometimes people take the MVP, minimum viable products stuff too far extreme. But I think that, you know, if you have a new idea, spending like 2 months to kind of build it out, kind of test it, and then launch that MVP, that's like often for a lot of things, a good barometer of like, to me, what's the appropriate amount of time to actually research and consider the idea.
Well, I think, you know, people forget the viable part a lot of times. Like, it's got to be viable. That's part of the phrase. The one thing is that in all this is that like, it's not going to be perfect. You're going to make mistakes. And you say that the real art lies not in avoiding mistakes, but in allowing them to shape your path forward. In your 20s and beyond, this truth becomes your North Star. Progress over perfection, action over analysis, and growth through doing rather than merely planning. Like, can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what exactly do you mean by that? It's like making mistakes and that being like an expected part of the process.
Yeah, we're all going to fail inevitably within our lives. And one of the things that I emphasize is the importance of not viewing failure as just this thing to look down upon, but to look at every mistake and every experience, even ones you dislike, as ones that can teach you valuable things. When I was doing an internship, or I did a bunch of internships when I was in university, there were some internships that I did where I realized afterwards, like, no way, don't want to do that at all. And even though I didn't love the experience at the time, I gained like a valuable experience from it. And in the career development kind of literature, there's a line that like every work experience, you gain a little bit more career clarity about what you like and what you don't like. And for a young person, I encourage like listeners to embrace that. Like, think about how you can learn from every kind of experience. And there is no perfect career clarity, but I do think there's an opportunity as you get older, as you have more career experiences, for you to gain an enhanced understanding about what is the career that best aligns with your skills, your interests, your passion, et cetera.
There's like an expression like it's not failure if you learn from it or something. I don't know what the exact expression is, but it's just part of the process. The last chapter is on networking, and this is the one that I probably could have used before I started my business, because nothing was worse for me than going to a trade show where there's all these people and been giving 2 drink tickets and having to walk into a room full of like 300 people and having to make small talk and kind of generate leads for my business. So what is networking? And I think there's a lot of misconceptions. What is it and what is it not?
I think a misconception that's pretty common about networking is that it is all about just getting as many business cards and extracting as much value from people as possible. And I think what networking is at its best is it's about growing a network. It's about building a network that's both wide and deep. What I mean by that is wide is that you have a large number of acquaintances that you know, but it's deep in the sense you also have a large number or moderate number of people you know really deeply who you can reach out to who are close friends or family members. And I think that that, you know, is important to emphasize. I also would say that what networking is it's about adding value to other people. Adam Grant has a great book called Give and Take, where he talks about how the most successful people are those who are givers, but they're givers with guardrails. So rather than going into a networking room and thinking about how can I extract value from people, and I see that a lot of times at conferences where there might be like people there that are particularly important, and someone just has a list and they're thinking, oh, I want to hit up all these specific people. And that always kind of gives me a little bit of ick, versus kind of just going into a room and just chatting with people at random and then seeing kind of who you make kind of different connections and you think about how you can kind of help them. And I think that is truly more successful networking than the sort of assassin type networking where you're just going into an event and you're trying to swoop in and talk to 1 or 2 people who you think can add value to you.
Right. Yeah. Hey, how you doing? Where you from? Hey, how you doing? Where you from? None of that stuff. But really, like, how can I add to the situation? Yeah, this would have been very good for me. Now, do we have to do this?
Do we have to network?
Like, yeah. I mean, can I, if I'm shy and I don't, can I like get by without doing this, or is it pretty key?
I think networking is pretty key for pretty much everyone. And that's not necessarily going to like networking events, but I think it's really important that people actually spend time about consciously like growing their networks. And, you know, what I would recommend is that like every week, if you're a young person, think about like meeting someone new. And over time that can compound to a lot of like new people. Every day, pretty much I meet new people through my work, both present and past. And I've loved that. And I've met like, I keep a tally. I think I've met like 8,000 people. And it's been like an amazing kind of journey. And I've become way more comfortable meeting with people who I didn't previously know. I was way more introverted, way more socially uncomfortable a decade ago than I think I am today. And if you're a young person who maybe struggles with that, like I did, it's all to say that it is a teachable skill. It gets better. And the way you get better at it is you meet a lot of strangers.
Well, listen, this was a great tour of your book. This is the book. It's called The Uncertainty Advantage, Launching Your Career in an Era of Rapid Change. I got it on Amazon, but I'm sure you could probably get it at American bookstores like Barnes & Noble or whatever.
Yeah, it's available at Barnes & Noble, on Amazon in the US. And if you're interested in learning more about me, one thing that I recommend listeners do is check out a quiz that I have online, and you can find it by Googling my name or just going scottster.com/quiz.
Oh, we'll put this in the show notes. Okay.
Perfect.
And what's in the quiz?
The quiz is like 2 minutes, and it will give you a score from 0 to 48 in terms of how comfortable you are with uncertainty. Because the first step of learning to develop a better relationship with uncertainty is learning what is your current relationship with uncertainty. And I think this quiz can be really helpful for you in building your uncertainty muscles.
Well, it's, as they say, a VUCA world, a volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world. And uncertainty is just something we're all going to have to live with. So if it's just going to be a key part of developing a career. So I highly recommend the book. Scott, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yes. If you like this episode, please share it with your friends. Like our podcast on whatever platform you're on. And if you can, please be grateful for something today.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe to Dream Job Cafe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to check out wayspark.co, where we help people navigate careers in a crazy world.